welcome to the Learner's Corner podcast. My name is Caleb Mason, and I am so grateful that you have decided to spend a few minutes of your day here with me in the Learner's Corner. And today, for episode 400, I am honored to be joined by Nancy French to talk with her about her brand new book, Ghosted, An American Story. And we're going to get into that in just a few minutes. However, before we continue with the conversation, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, I do want to let you know a couple of things. One, that here in the podcast, we want to create a safe place to have difficult conversations, to have conversations that are around maybe difficult subjects and areas to where there may not be a ton of agreement, or there may be a vast ocean of opinions, a vast ocean of different perspectives as well. And we want to create the place, I want to create the place to where we can have conversations amidst all of those different opinions. And we really believe that we can learn from anyone and from everyone, from anything and from everything. And we're going to cover the gamut today in my conversation with Nancy, to where we really look on her story and her life, of just some of the big things that she's learned about, from choosing your values to living a double life, to escaping shame or setting people free from shame, just many different things. Now, let me tell you a little bit, actually before that. So if you are on this lifelong journey of learning, please subscribe to the podcast, and you can sign up to my Substack as well, to where I give different things that are currently making me think, some of the things that are engaging my curiosity and my imagination as well. Now, let me tell you about Nancy, and then we will jump into the conversation. Nancy French is a 5-time New York Times bestselling author, and as a ghostwriter, she has written for a variety of people, from government officials to celebrities. As an investigative journalist, she uncovered sexual and spiritual abuse in America's largest Christian camp, and we're going to get into all that stuff as well. So without any further wait, here is our conversation. Well, Nancy, it is so good to have you on the Learner's Corner podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Caleb. This is fun.
Yeah, and you know, anytime that I have somebody on and they have created a work of art, in this case it's your book, your memoir, Ghosted, I love hearing the origin story behind what got someone to write something or to produce this work of art. And so I would just be interested to hear, one, kind of your origin story, and even just a little bit of a summary of what the book is about, because it kind of is your story. I mean, and not kind right. of, is it is your story.
Yeah, well, asking for an origin story, it makes me feel like I should tell you about getting bitten by a radioactive spider or something. So I've been a ghostwriter for many years. And as I approached 50, I realized that I was hiding behind other people's stories. And so I feel like I, through counseling and other things, had gotten to the point of emotional wellness to the degree that I at least could start writing my own story. And so Ghosted has sort of a double meaning. On the one hand, I've been a ghostwriter forever, but on the other hand, this is the story of being rejected by groups of people that you thought might support you. And it's written for all of those people out there who feel spiritually, culturally, or even geographically homeless during this weird time. And it's sort of like me reaching out my hand and saying, hey, you're not alone. And, we can be together in this. So hopefully this will resonate with people all across America who are sort of sick of the way things are going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was curious to hear, especially with you being a ghostwriter, talk to me about like the difference between writing somebody else's story or writing about events that don't involve you versus doing the work of, I mean, just as you mentioned, you were writing your own story.
Caleb, it is so hard to write your own story. I wanted to hire a ghostwriter to write my story, but I couldn't afford it. It's so crazy. I've written one New York Times bestselling book in 24 days. So I'm super fast. My spiritual gift is alacrity. And so I thought I could maybe do this pretty quickly, but it probably took me 8 months. Like, I labored over every syllable. I love it I love the fact that I did it. It was the worst, most difficult writing that maybe I've done, other than the Kanakuk investigation. And, you know, some of my other, you know, investigative work is difficult, but this was so emotionally difficult that I'm glad it's over and I'm glad I have it and I love it, but man, it took a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to go back to your experience in ghost writing. Talk to me, because I'm curious, as I imagine that you have to do some interviewing and things like that in order to get to know the people better. And I would just be curious to hear, like, what have you learned as a ghost writer that helps you get to know other people better and, you know, quicker or deeper?
I feel like I have something about me that connects with people quickly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I am able to form a bond fast with people and to immediate, like, pass the cursory sort of, hey, how are you? What do you like to do on the weekends? Who's your NBA team? Like, beyond that, I immediately make connections with people. And I always have. I could go to the bathroom in the airport and wash my hands and leave the bathroom and say, I just met the nicest person from Mayfield, Kentucky, whose husband died in 93. But now she's better because now she's starting, you know, like, and my husband is like, literally, you were in there for 30 seconds. It's just weird. And I don't know if other people feel that way or if it's inherent to me, but I have this ability to connect. But ghostwriting is so wonderful because you get to connect with people on and their stories. And it's so sacred and wonderful. I just think it's such a beautiful way to interact with people.
Mm-hmm. Like, whenever you're connecting with people, do you just lead with, like, what's happening with you? Or is it just like, hey, I'm just asking this question or this deep question?
Yeah. Well, with books, you know, usually they call me because they have one big thing that happened to them. So, you know, like Bristol Palin was somebody who got pregnant, obviously, during the presidential campaign when her mother was the GOP nominee. And Sean Lowe, The Bachelor, you know, he was on this great TV show, or Sean Johnson was an Olympian. So usually I unpack the big event, but then I start from scratch, from the start, talk about their childhood, how they got there. So yeah, so I don't really have a set, like, question list. Mm-hmm. It's just conversation like we're having now, and I record everything and I get to hear it in their own voice. So, like, Caleb, where do you live?
In Akron, Ohio.
Okay. Well, Caleb with Akron, Ohio probably has different language and diction than I do. So I might, if I was doing your book, I might throw in some y'alls. You mm-hmm. might not say that. In fact, I put in some y'alls when I was working for Sarah Palin. And I think she was like, I don't say y'all. And I was like, oh, interesting. It feels like you should. But anyway, so, like, when you record people's voices and you hear their story in real time, you can get their voice down perfectly because you're just recording it. Mm-hmm. But then after you transcribe it and clean it up for grammar, you know, it just, that's how you really focus on the storytelling part of it.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about, you know, you mentioned some of the people that you ghostwrited for, and, you know, they're more well known than maybe the average person is. And I would just be curious to hear, like, what are some of the things that you've just learned about, I don't know, this is such a generic question, so take it wherever you want, but what are just some of the things that you've learned from learning to ghostwrite other people's stories that has just resonated with you since you've been doing it?
Well, I always start with the same statement to all of my clients, which is, do not feel pressure about this book. We are not writing your story. God is writing your story. Mm. And he's already done it. So we don't have to fret. We don't have to worry about it. And the scriptures make it clear that, you know, the path of a righteous man are ordered by the Lord, you know? And so it's just fun to sort of sit back and see what God has done in people's lives. I felt that so strongly with so many clients. And then I got to do it for myself, you know? So I just think that's very beautiful.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I want to go back to what you mentioned. Kind of one of the big themes of the book is being rejected by people that you wish that you could find a place amongst.
Right.
And so one of the things that stands out to me, and you know, you write this several times throughout the book, is you're often too conservative for liberals, and you're way too, and you're too liberal for many conservatives as well, particularly, you know, as you write about some of the Trump years and everything too. Would you mind just talking to me just a little bit more of that dynamic of, and again, it could be liberal, conservative, take it however you want, but just that feeling of just of rejection.
Yeah. So I grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh, not only on his radio show, but on his television show, which I recorded on VHS. And I would watch it when I came home from school. I've always been a Republican. I've always been a very conservative, though I briefly flirted with liberalism in college. But I've always generally been conservative, and I never changed. And then in 2016, all of the things that we said we believed were tossed in the incinerator, and nobody noticed. And so I felt weird and slightly like gaslit, because I was like, you know, conservatives generally support the military. And yet now we're standing here mocking a prisoner of war, John McCain, because he got captured in his military service. Is this what we do? You know, like, it's weird. Like, I didn't love John McCain's, like, McCain-Feingold. But that's not what it was. This was mocking an American who heroically tried to protect our nation. And then we were okay with that. Like, it was so baffling. And that's just one example of 50 million. So I don't feel like I've changed. Like, here in Tennessee, sometimes people are like, well, you're just a liberal because you don't support Trump. And I always say, well, I'm too conservative to support Trump. Like, I'm conservative. So I don't, this is not what conservatives do. But, you know, there's something about that geographical sense of homelessness, in that here in Tennessee, everyone's pointing at me and saying that I'm a liberal when I am not. Mm. And then when I go to New York, they look at me and they're like, oh, you're a conservative. And so it's like, yes, I am. You know, it's just that I don't agree with a bunch of the stuff that we've been doing for the past few years, and I will not stop talking about it. So it makes me feel just like people have a difficult time putting me in a, you know, in their mind. Like, you know, it's easy to categorize people, but it's mm-hmm. like I defy categorization in a way that I think frustrates people. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, very much intrigued me by talking about, hey, you're too, it's actually not that I'm liberal or I'm not conservative enough. I'm too conservative for that.
Yeah.
Which it just makes me think of, like, whether it's, you know, them changing, or even you having your own definition of, hey, this is what it means to be a faithful conservative, or even, hey, this is what it means for your own personal values as yeah. well. Like, would you mind just you just got me intrigued by saying, like, hey, I'm too conservative. Would you mind just elaborating a little bit more on that?
Well, I mean, if you just talk sexually, just let's take the topic. You can pick 50 million topic, but let's take the topic of sexual predation. Mm-hmm. In 1998, when I found out about Bill Clinton and all of the credible rape allegations against him, I was infuriated, as was the Southern Baptist Church. And the SBC sent out this big proclamation about the importance of, you know, moral character in our leaders. I believed that in 98. I believe that now. It's so baffling to me that everyone sort of changed their mind on it. And so I don't try to pick fights with people. But like, you sort of want to ask people, were you wrong about Bill Clinton? Mm-hmm. You know, and, or are you wrong now? So which is, you know, cause it's very similar, yeah. you know, except that Trump has actually been held liable in court for his sexual predation. So anyway, it's like worse, and nobody seems to notice that this huge thing has changed. You know, like 5 minutes ago, people were pro-life. And then Donald Trump makes this announcement saying to do what's in your own heart and let states decide. And everyone's like, that's great. That's so pro-life. And you're like, what? Yeah. That's not, like, I am so, like, do words have meaning anymore? I don't even know.
Yeah. What do you think's behind that? Like, is it just like maybe they were valuing something more important than whatever the thing was? And so, you know, hey, I'm valuing, you know, this thing, but it's more important than this lower value. So I decided the value, the more important value of whatever I think it is. I don't know.
Yes,
I don't
Caleb.
Know if I'm making sense.
No, you're making perfect sense. I'm assuming that you've read Lord of the Rings.
I have not, but I've seen the movies and it's on my bucket list to
Caleb.
Read.
Yes. What the heck? I did not know I agreed to be on a podcast with a guy who has not read Tolkien. Right. No. So in Lord of the Rings, obviously Gollum wants power, right? Yeah. And everybody wants power. And so I thought that we had my mistake was I believed it all, and it was all a lie. So I think that my mistake was I thought we had deeply held biblical beliefs, but actually we just wanted power.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that you mentioned in the book that I would just love to have, it was so intriguing to me. And it's whenever you write about you and David deciding for him to go to Afghanistan, and you make this statement there where you say you both decided that it was more important to live out our values than to be present for every moment. Can you just talk to me just a little bit and just elaborate more on that?
Yeah, when David joined the army after 9/11, because there was recruiting shortfalls, he was very sobered by the idea that he'd be away from our kids. At the time we had two, we now have three. And, but because parenting in modern society is defined as being at all the soccer games, going to all the recitals, you know, all of that quality time. But what do you do if you can't have quality time? What do you do if you can't have time at all as a parent? And so, you know, there are adults that have to be in the army. So how do you do that? And so when David decided to join the army, almost universally, people were like, well, what about your kids? And so we just decided that it was more important for our kids to see us following God's, you know, leading in our lives than it was to be at every soccer game. Mm-hmm. And I think that's right. It was a difficult decision, and I'm sure other people make different decisions, but the fact that my kids were able to see David go to war, understand what freedom actually cost, and seeing his, you know, life pre and post Iraq was just very beautiful. And I think it was the right decision, and I'm very thankful he came back. But before he left, you know, we weren't high in the sky with the kids. You know, they'd say, is he coming back? And I'd say, you know, we don't know this, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully, but life is complicated and shorter than you think and longer than you think in some way. So, you know, we sort of approached it very soberly. And I'm very proud of the kids because I feel like it allowed them to see that they aren't the center of the universe. Not that they had that proclivity. I think all of us have that proclivity to think that the world definitely should revolve around me. I don't know why y'all didn't get the memo. But, you know, for the kids, you know, doing that one decision really helped us with our parenting in a lot of ways that are difficult to sort of describe. Mm-hmm.
Is there like another example that either you or you and David or, you know, whatever example of living out your values that that you've just thought about in like similar terms versus maybe being present or even like, hey, I'm living out this value and, you know, modeling this for your kids?
You know, probably, yeah. I mean, there's so much, including but not limited to adoption. You know, that's a very difficult way to increase your family size, but we felt called to do that. And when we made that decision to adopt, we sat our older two kids down and we were like, this could be hard. You know, this could be hard for the rest of our lives, but you do what God calls you to do. And, you know, and God controls the consequences of all that. And so that was beautiful. And being able to take my older two kids to Africa to meet Naomi in Ethiopia and to see that was life changing. Mm-hmm. And it helped them have compassion on their new little sister. You know, and that was several years ago, 13 years ago. And she's flourishing and she's amazing. And she completes our family in such a beautiful way. I'm so thankful we made that decision. And I'm thankful that the kids were a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes me think of so, and you mentioned one of the times, but there's several times throughout the book to where like you and David, or even just you, have to follow your values. And sometimes it doesn't make sense. And you have so many people who are maybe saying like, I think of you two getting married after such a short time. And everybody's like, are you sure about this? You know, do you need to? And I don't know. It just makes me think of, at some point, all of us are going to have circumstances in our lives to where it doesn't make sense, but we decide to move forward, whether it be because of our values or because of whether it be like a choice for love or something along those lines, to where it's like, I know that this doesn't make sense, but because of my values, or I feel like this is where God is leading me, I have to go forward. Can you just speak to that dynamic just a little bit?
Yeah. It seems like over and over in this book, it's us making a weird decision that no one really supported. And definitely the love and romance part of it. I met David and we were married, even though we didn't know each other at all, after like 3 months. And so everybody was opposed to that. And then when I wrote about that in the Washington Post, I thought it was great. But then I got all these comments saying, come on, this is the dumbest advice. I wasn't giving advice, yeah. But they were like, this is the dumbest story. I married someone. He turned out to be a serial killer or had a separate family in Toledo or something. And so I recognize that it was asinine to marry a complete stranger. But 28 years later, it's my story and I'm very thankful for it. But there's a bunch of stuff like some people close to us didn't want us to adopt because it would be too hard, or they definitely didn't want David to join the army because it would be too hard, or they didn't want him deployed because he could die. It's just life is hard and complicated. And if you make decisions like we have, a lot of times people won't understand you and it sort of makes you feel a little isolated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It honestly made me think of, me and my wife got married after a very short time too, not quite 3 months, but
okay.
And we were 30 whenever it happened, but we met and married in 6 months, and it's still, I can relate to that dynamic of like, yeah, things are crazy. And you know, I know this seems it came out of nowhere, but here.
And how long ago was that?
So we've been married a little over a year now.
Okay.
And so
okay.
Obviously, you know, not almost 30, but so far so good for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Well, sometimes you just know, you know?
Yep. Yep. You know, I want to go back to the rejection and finding community and finding your people as well, because another dynamic that you write about in there that it's not so much on the rejection side, I guess, but on the secrecy side of it, of holding a secret or living, and you write about living a double life in order to be a part of community.
Mm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think of, like, if we're going to go like the rejection thing, I almost think of it as like the community is rejecting us. And then the secrecy or the double life, I almost think of it like I'm afraid that I'm going to get rejected. So I am going to hold this secret.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. So I was the victim of a pedophile vacation Bible school teacher when I was at church in rural Tennessee as a kid when I was about 12. And it was really terrible for all the reasons you already know, but also mm-hmm. because I loved church. I went 3 times a week. I had the pantyhose. I liked the little cookies at vacation Bible school that you would put on your pinky and eat, you know, the sugar cookies or whatever. I loved all of that. And then when I was abused, it took that community away from me because I would go to church and the abuser would be there. And he was, you know, hanging out with all the kids. And I was sort of pushed to the outskirts. So I, you know, started smoking cigarettes on the edge of the church property and skipping Sunday school because I didn't have any place to go. And so either I was, you know, sadly smoking my clove cigarettes by myself with black fingernail polish on, or I was faking my faith and my positive, you know, attitude to be in church. So it's sort of like when you're sexually abused, it sets you up where you either have to be deceptive and hide all the stuff that happened to you or come clean. But people don't come clean about being victims of pedophilia for decades, usually late 40s, early 50s. And so, you know, I am late 40s doing that very thing. And so, you know, that I think sexual abuse robs you of your community in ways that you don't necessarily notice.
Mm-hmm. Well, even you write about, especially towards the end of the book, whenever you start doing, you know, your journalism and your investigative reporting is, you know, you call so many of the victims of people who have, you know, been sexually abused and everything, who have to whatever degree been silenced and have been rejected by either their faith community or maybe their family or even, you know, just the broader community at large. Talk to me about like just your experience with hearing other people's stories and being able to whatever degree, like give them a voice or give them a microphone or just even just let them know that, hey, everybody it may seem like everybody's trying to silence you, but I'm actually trying to hear you and I'm trying to listen.
Yes, I was not super comfortable talking about my sexual abuse when I started the Kanakuk investigation. Kanakuk is the camp in Branson, Missouri, where there's been many predators and hundreds of victims, and they're still operational and never been held accountable. And I started that investigation with a bunch of shame over my own story. And then I got on the phone with these survivors, and they were amazing, and I loved them, and they were so courageous. And suddenly I was able to look at the survivors and say, I would never think that these people are deficient morally or in any way. I would never think that they're worthless. I would never think that they're pieces of trash. And that's the language I would tell myself about myself. Mm-hmm. So after I got to spend time with all of these wonderful victims of abuse, they were so lovely. It made me love myself. Mm-hmm. I was like, why would I be so contemptuous of myself when these guys are amazing? You know, like I wouldn't hold their abuse against them. So why do I hold it against me?
Mm-hmm. You know, you talking about it, it's obviously, you know, what we're talking about is serious and it's not very funny, but it makes me think of what I think is a very funny incident that you write about in your story, because I think as, I can't remember the timeline exactly, but I remember that as you were dealing with your sexual abuse, you were meeting with a counselor and they gave you some homework to do. And do you want to tell us about what happened at Waffle House then, and even just the homework a little bit?
Yeah. So my counselor was like, so you checked this box about being sexually abused on the intake form, and we've not talked about it for 7 months. Do you want to tell me about that? And I was like, no, I don't think so. I just couldn't tell it. I couldn't make my mouth form the words. I was so shame filled. So he was like, well, I know you're a writer. Why don't you go home and just jot down on a piece of paper what happened, and you can bring it back in and I can read it. You don't have to say it, and we can go from there. So I agreed to this. I drive to Waffle House, which is where all amazing creativity occurs, and had my favorite hash brown bowl and coffee. And I start writing this down, and I end up writing something that I think is actually super powerful. So I submitted it to the Washington Post, and it got published. And the next week I walk in, and my counselor was like, were you able to write down on a piece of paper and bring it in? And I was like, yeah. And I handed him the Washington Post, and he was like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is not typically what we do, but I'm sure this will be fine. And, you know, it was awful and chaotic, and yeah. I'm very glad I did it. But yeah, it was pretty funny.
Yeah. Yep. You know, the other thing that I want to talk about, you know, we've been, you know, maybe alluding to or not talk. We've been talking about examples of is suffering. Suffering is another big thing that just shows up all throughout the book. We've talked about it with sexual abuse. There's also like some death also that happens throughout the book of some people who are close to you. And I would just love, as much as you're comfortable sharing, talk to me about what you've learned about God, or even just what you've learned about life in regards to suffering.
Oh man. So anybody who gets the audible version of Ghosted is going to hear me very emotionally tell these stories. I could mm-hmm. not get it out of my mouth without weeping, because I knew what was coming for some of these people. Also, I cried at my dedication to David French. I love him so much. And every time I thought about it, I would like just start crying. They were like, oh my gosh, literally stop it. I'm sure it was super annoying. But like in the Kanakuk thing, like so many people died. Some of the victims committed suicide. I think you're supposed to say died via suicide. And then even one predator died via suicide. And, you know, I just felt like I was re-traumatizing people by doing the work that I was doing. And then we had more deaths after the investigation started. And it was just treacherous. But I think it's so important to think about death and to engage with people wherever they are. You know, last year, at the end of the year, the book is not about cancer, but in the end of last year, I got a cancer diagnosis, triple negative, very aggressive. And, already spread to the lymph nodes. And I started thinking about death almost immediately, because I got the diagnosis when I was with my philosophy major son, who goes to UC Santa Cruz. And so we started talking about memento mori. Are you familiar with this?
I am. Yep.
And I, which is remember that you must die. And philosophers and artists throughout history have this memento mori idea. It's represented by a skull frequently in art. But it's a reminder that if you are cognizant of your death, that you're never more fully alive. And I swear, Caleb, it sounds counterintuitive and not true. And it is truth. It's generally true that I feel more alive now than I've ever felt. And I'm, you know, 5.5 months into chemo and puking my guts out and can't get out of the bed frequently. Bald as an eagle. But I feel alive. And I think there's something about that. I think the church is so uncomfortable with disability, disease, and death that they try to rush you to the cure. So they find out you have cancer and they're like, have you done? And the list of things that come out of their mouth are shocking. But it's because they want to rush to the cure without realizing that there's much beauty to be had in disease, in disability. You can see the world differently. And I'm very thankful for that. I want to live. But right now I'm just sort of enjoying this new perspective between puking.
Talk to me, like, any thoughts on to why you're experiencing what you're experiencing right now?
You mean the cancer stuff? Well, or
just what you're saying, like, it, like, with everything that you have been through and everything that even you're going go through, there's lots of reasons to not have hope. There's lots of reasons to not feel full of life that you're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious to any thoughts on, like, what's helping you feel alive?
Oh, right. You know, I don't exactly know. I feel very fortunate because I have a wonderful support system and my family is awesome. Mm-hmm. My son, the philosopher who went to UC Santa Cruz, asked if he could come home and live with us to help take care of me. And I said, absolutely not. I want you to graduate or whatever. And of course he disobeyed me and came home and now he's here. And he's amazing. You know, like we play Wordle. We play Upwords every day. Mm-hmm. I play Wordle with David French every night, but we play Upwords every day. He drives and takes my youngest to school and other places. And my church community has been so supportive. The online community has been so sweet. Like, I know that I complain a great deal about social media and its acrimonious effect on our lives. But when I came out as a cancer victim / patient / whatever, everybody's been so nice. I cannot tell you the outpouring of love that I've received. I feel swaddled in love. And the whole theme of my book was trusting God. Mm-hmm. And conveniently, that is actually true. I do believe that he's trustworthy, you know? Yeah. And so this is not really any different from all the other dramas that we've had, you know, and that are represented in that book. It's pretty significant and grave, but, you know, I just feel taken care of and loved.
Mm. You know, even you talking about that, and it makes me think of resiliency, which is also another theme in the book. Any additional thoughts? And we've kind of been talking about resilience, but any additional thoughts on that?
You know what? I'm actually interested because I never thought about resilience being a theme of the book, actually. But I guess it is because I think the one thing that I have in life is that I don't get tired of doing stuff. Mm-hmm. I think I could work like in Henry Ford's, you know, like line, you know, like I could just do the same thing. Like I went into my art studio the other day and I stayed for 10 hours and I was like, oh, I should probably go to bed now. Like I just love to do stuff. And like with the Kennecuck investigation, I started investigating. I thought I would do it for 1 month. It took me 3 years. I'm still sort of dealing with it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, like sometimes it just takes time to do the good things. And I feel like that's one thing that I can do. You just tell me a task and I'll do it forever until you tell me to stop.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes after you tell me to stop.
You know, I want to read this quote because it's one of the things that I think will stand out to me most from the book. And it's a little bit lengthy of a quote, and it's towards the end. And it's, you're writing about your parents in okay. Reflection. And you say, I couldn't turn around and judge my parents with the psychological and emotional tools I had because of their bravery, which they did not have because of their upbringing. they'd sacrifice so I could have a better life in a different perspective. It would no longer do to accept the abundance of their sacrifice, only to turn it against them. I wanted to love them as well as I could during the years we had left. And I think the thing that just resonates so strongly with me is we can sometimes become resentful of the people who have helped us get to where we are and who have lifted us up. And we're like, why aren't you where I'm at today?
Oh, that is so interesting, Caleb. I don't think I put this in the book, but watching you lift your hands when you said that, Caleb and I are seeing each other right now. Did I write that in the book about how they lifted me up on their hands? Because that is exactly what I've said. I don't think I did.
I honestly can't remember.
Caleb, I think you need to pay more attention to my writing. Memorize it next time. No, but it's interesting because I feel like my parents, who were hillbillies, are hillbillies, they lifted me up higher than they could have gone. And then I stood on their upraised arms, and then I went further than they could go. And, you know, hopefully my kids will go further than I went. But, you know, like, imagine, because I've had all this trauma counseling after what I've been through, but my parents haven't had one syllable of that. And, you know, being raised on the mountain, they saw so much more trauma than even I did, especially than I did, because they tried to protect me from that. And so, you know, like, my parents have never had the benefit of counseling. So after I go to counseling for a few years, I don't go back to them. And I'm like, listen, Dad, you know what you really should have done? Like, I just love my parents. You know, they got off the mountain. My dad realized it was not the right place to raise family. He joined the Marines at age 15 by lying about his name and his birthday. He served 3 years in the Marine Corps and then came back to high school. He was still so young. Never graduated from high school, got his GED, but he moved us off the mountain. So my experience living has been very different from my relatives who had to grow up on the mountain and had a different experience. And so part of the beauty of this book is being able to reach out to them and get to know them more. It's been very beautiful, but my parents are wonderful. I love them so much. And they've been just wonderfully supportive in this book, which is full of difficult things. So that's not easy, and it's to their credit.
Yeah. Talk to me about that, because you're facing your own story and coming to terms with your own story. And at the same point, you're being vulnerable with what you've experienced. And sometimes other people, like, I just think of your parents, like, you're coming to terms with it, but then, like, I'm trying to formulate my question better. You're coming to term with your experience and maybe what you've accepted, but then there's also other people coming to terms with what you've experienced too.
Right. That's super hard.
Yeah. And you know, whether it be family or close friends, talk to me about just that dynamic.
Yes. Even, you know, as I'm promoting the book and doing podcasts and talking about my sexual abuse, I have family members contact me and say, I never knew that. Mm-hmm. I was like, I know. But yeah, it's like, I am at the point where I want to be honest about everything, but other people live in your life. It's story, you know, characters in your story, more than that, just beautiful, you know, people who bear the image of God, and it's tough. But I feel like if you can trust that God is good and that Jesus is the truth with a capital T, you don't have to be afraid of the truth. You know, like, I'm not running to be the Pope. So, like, I don't have to, you know, present myself as some sort of, like, spiritual guru. I am not. And so I think it's just very beautiful if you can say, yeah, this bad stuff happened. Yeah, I did bad stuff. Yeah, I made mistakes. Yeah, I got that wrong. You know, like, it's good for everybody around you. And one of the things that we do is we try to infantilize the people in our lives. So frequently you'll talk to writers and they're like, you know, I would tell my story, but my parents aren't dead yet or whatever. But I feel like if you could just have conversations with your parents and your loved ones and your friends and your family and, you know, just have those difficult conversations, it's so much better to be honest with them while they're alive than letting them, you know, pass away and then you have your chance to be fully known. You're missing out on some beautiful opportunities.
So did you just, like, start the conversation then, or what did that look like for you?
Yes, I drove all the way to their house and said, I have secretly been writing a book. My publisher is already promoting it, and I've never told you. This is why. It's full of difficult things, and I'm coming here to ask not only for your permission, but for your blessing. And it was a beautiful 3-hour conversation. It was the most beautiful conversation I've ever had in my life. My parents were wonderful. They shared things with me that helped me understand some things in my childhood, and it was just very beautiful.
That's great. So I got two other things I want to ask you about. But before that, is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to make sure that we talk about or cover?
No, I don't think so. The book is so crazy, isn't it? There's so many things. It's hard to know how to sort of tackle it. So no, you're doing a great job. Thank you.
Okay, cool. So one, and we've mentioned him already, but one of the big, you know, for lack of a better term, characters in the book is your husband, David, too.
Yes.
And so I would just love to hear, you know, just what's either one aspect of gratitude that you have for David, or something that you've learned from David or appreciate about David.
Okay. So David French is the favorite punching bag of so many people online, of course, through, you know, his writings and stuff. People hate him with a hot burning passion that I have never seen before. However, the guy is amazing. I've been married to him for 28 years. I know that I have to say this because I'm his wife, but he's great. We've been married for 28 years. We got married spontaneously. The reason I married him so quickly is because after our first conversations, I said I would never get tired of talking to this person. Mm-hmm. And 28 years later, it's true. We have the most fascinating conversations. I love him so much. He's so fascinating. He's so interesting. But more than that, he has a moral backbone. So I just don't know where I'd be without him. I don't even know if I'd be alive without him because he came into my life. He told me about Jesus and the Holy Spirit in a way that made sense to me. And then ever since then, we've just been on this grand adventure. And David's decision to join the army, you know, that was a terrifying decision. He was part of the surge. His unit suffered more casualties than any other unit that during that time frame. And I saw him do that. And I would never have made that decision. Of course, I'm a, you know, housewife, but I would never have made that decision. And then I see him do it, you know, and it's like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, we can do hard things. And that decision paved the way for other hard things. So when he came back from Iraq, it was like, oh, adoption is hard. Oh, we can do hard things. And we could. And now we have a beautiful daughter, you know. But everybody was like, oh, no, you should not do that. You should not go to Africa. You should not go to Ethiopia. You should not adopt a kid. You should not bring in a stranger to your house, whatever. And we were like, yeah, we can do this. And then later, you know, like when the opposing Trump was going to come at such a big social cost as well as other cost, you know, we can do hard things. And it's the easiest thing in the world to oppose Donald Trump, who's a credibly accused rapist, who's been held accountable in the court of law. It's not even hard to do that, Caleb, but it came at a cost. And but by that time, we'd sort of practiced our comes at a cost muscles. You know, like we were like, OK, yeah, we can do this. We don't have to go to the cocktail parties in Franklin, Tennessee. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing I want to ask you about, and you write about it in the last chapter, is you, and again, this you probably have better language for it, but I'll just say of finding God again, or just dealing with maybe some of the disillusionment that life has brought. And so would you mind just talking just a little bit about that too?
Yeah. So when I was abused in the church context, it sort of ruined my relationship with God because I was so baffled and confounded because I didn't understand why they were teaching me one thing from the pulpit and doing another thing behind closed doors. And I just didn't know what to believe. Later, when David introduced me to God, I accepted Jesus immediately, was filled with the Holy Spirit, and I never looked back. I just love God so much. I am completely despondent over the state of the church. I'm sick of so many church people. And the reason I say that, I'm not even going to soften this. I'm just rawly telling you the truth. I am so sad over the current state of the church. Mm-hmm. I thought when I was a kid and I was being abused by my vacation Bible school teacher, I thought that was like the secret thing and nobody knew. And if people knew this, they would be outraged. But then later I found out that like everybody knew it was an open secret. He abused 15 other people in my church. That same level of sadness and grief exist in me now because of what's happening in the church. So when I was a kid, abuse happened. The church collectively shrugs, does nothing to stop it. I investigate Kennecott camps for 3 years. The church collectively shrugs, does nothing to stop it. The Southern Baptist, you know, this big revelation of all of this abuse. Nobody cares. There's no justice. And I feel sad about that. But here's the thing. I'm not deconstructing. I feel like God and I are fine. I feel like I trust God so much. I love him so much. And I feel like he has a vice grip on my life and my destiny. So I'm not deconstructing. I'm so sick of the way things are going in church. It just makes me feel spiritually homeless, you know, which is the theme of the book. It's like, where do you go when people don't care about you, when they should be protecting the innocent, you know, the innocent children? Innocent children should be an easy line.
No.
But anyway, I'm sad. I've been in a bad mood for like 4 years though, five, six. I don't know.
Yeah. What, like, cause I don't know. I'm just curious to just have you just expound more on why you continue to trust God, even at the state of the church, because I just think of so many people who are like, I see the church and I want nothing to do with God.
Yes. Well, God has. So I decided to be honest in this memoir, which is a choice. I've written a lot of books and it's a choice. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was honest about was I've had some crazy things happen spiritually. And like I've had dreams that seem prescient or that were prescient. People in my family have had visions or been prophecies, stuff that's just not your typical church fare, but God has shown, and I just told it. I don't even understand it. Some of it actually makes me mad. I'm like, God, why would you do that? That's so confounding, but it obviously was God. So I just decided to include all of the supernatural things that have happened to me and to let the reader decide. Like I don't even understand some of it. I still can't get over some of the things that I feel like God orchestrated in my life that it feels like maybe for no reason, or it feels actually harmful or whatever, but I included it. I did not tidy it up. I just put all the sort of loose stories in there without figuring it out. I don't know theology. I don't even want to know theology. I feel like my whole life I've been obsessed with theology, and I was surrounded by people who were theologically orthodox, but behaviorally heretical because they had the right positions, but they would not protect a kid from a pedophile to save their life or to save their ministries. You know, they just won't. And so I'm over all of that, but I love God so much. And he's shown up in my life repeatedly. And I include some of those stories in the book just so people can understand. Like, there's no way I can go back after the things I've seen because I've seen them with my own eyes. And it might not be the type of thing that could convince, you know, my postman of God's existence, but it is evidence to me. And I feel it to the core of my soul. And I just trust him.
Well, Nancy, any other things on your mind before we wrap up our conversation?
No, I'm so excited to meet you and excited about the new marriage and your spontaneous lovebirds, just like we are. This is great. No, I appreciate it. And I've been so enjoying this conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Well, likewise. And I know that people are going to want to keep up with you and get ghosted. Where's the best place for people to go to do those things?
Yes, nancyfrench.com has all my stuff on it, including my investigative journalism, if you want to look at that and become outraged on my behalf or on the behalf of the victims of that camp. But also on Twitter, it's Nancy A. French. On Threads, it's Nancy Jane French. On Instagram, it's Nancy Jane French. I don't know. Just Google me. But my website is nancyfrench.com.
Awesome. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. Thanks for the great conversation. And just thank you for doing the work and for sharing it with us.
All right, Caleb, it's so nice. Thank you so much for your interest in the book.
So, a lot of different things that have got me thinking from this conversation, but I think two things that I want to mention is, you know, this quote from Brandon Sanderson or this idea from Brandon Sanderson, who is a fantasy fiction writer. And he talks about this idea of journey before destination and focusing on the journey versus the goal or the destination to where you want to end up. And as with Nancy's stories, I've been doing a lot of I've been reading a lot of books on biographies of people or memoirs or autobiographies on people. And I think it's really just making me reflect and think on just on that idea of focus on the journey, not so much on the destination. The destination is important, but it's the journey along the way. It's what we learn along the way. It's who we're with along the way that has the power. That's ultimately what's most important. And sometimes I think I can get distracted by the destination. And I'd like to think that I've gotten a lot better at it, but I still got a long way to go before that. And the other thing is what we talked about in not judging your parents or not judging the people who came before you for what they didn't do or what they didn't have, that they did the best that they could and they helped, you know, they helped get you or helped get me to where I am today. And they helped make it so that I have access to those tools. They have access to those resources. I have access to those people. And just realizing that they helped make that possible, even though that may not have been possible for them. So honestly, just this conversation is just making me filled with just a ton of gratitude for just a lot of different things that I'm thinking about. So I think that's all that I have for today. So I do want to say, I am going to say thank you to some of the people who helped make this possible. But before that, you know, if you're on this lifelong journey of learning, please subscribe to my Substack, where I have different resources of some of the things that I'm thinking about, engaging my imagination, curiosity, you know, all of those good things there. Now, before we wrap up, I do want to say thank you to Nancy French for the great conversation that we had, to Sam Massey for the new music that we have today and going forward on the podcast. And thank you for listening all the way to the end of the episode. My name is Caleb Mason, and until next time, keep learning and keep growing.